One of the interesting articles that appeared in the Wall Street Journal is about the technology companies. We're always talking about NVIDIA, and we're talking about Facebook or Meta or Amazon or Apple, but looks like an old school name has come back to be popular.
Yes, everybody forgets how influential the energy industry is, but it keeps everything chugging, including all the aforementioned companies that everybody is so obsessed with.
So we're talking about Exxon. Exxon is a company that has amazing, strong demand because the global economy is stronger than ever. And guess what? Because of Ukraine and the Middle East and now Israel and, oh gosh, everything that's going on. The increased Israel and Iran escalation, looks like oil prices are steady yeti.
Yeah, definitely.
And sometimes old school companies tend to come back and smile.
Well, it's one of the, it's a bedrock company. I kind of view it, you know, in more ways than one.
Yeah, I mean, look, everybody's been talking about falling inflation. I've been talking about bond yields. And, you know, listen, a lot of people in bonds got slaughtered a few years ago.
Yeah, yeah, especially.
So, you know, a lot of people, not our clients, I'm going to tell you that right now, not our clients. Those of you who were buying bonds in the 0% range or the 1% range when inflation went up, they lost value if you sold them. If you hang on to them, you're doing fine. But
problem is a lot of people don't have the option to not sell because they own bond funds, whether they're mutual funds or ETFs or whatever. And those funds are forced to rotate based on certain criteria or whatever. And, you know, they lost value purely because the fund itself is a marketable security, and speculation against the assets that they hold caused the value of the fund to go down. So it's just a lot of people got screwed no matter which way you slice it. You know, I mean, we've talked about this in the past. So few people own individual bonds. It's actually kind of scary. It's almost entirely funds and large institutions.
And I've talked about extensively the cost for funds. I'll mention a name, Carol, who works with us. She said there, when I did that thing, like, man, you scared the hell out of me on bonds because there's the cost of it and the lack of transparency is really substantial.
Yeah, absolutely.
So bond funds are bundled financial products, and very few people buy bonds. But basically the Federal Reserve is doing what the Federal Reserve needs to do. Powell's doing what Powell's doing. But I got to tell you, Exxon, ahead of Microsoft and Apple and Alphabet, Tesla's gotten slaughtered. What do you think about that?
I haven't done the analysis, but my guess is that Tesla is overly exposed, but just as exposed on a kind of electric car per capita basis in the drop in interest in them. A lot of people who purchased them got them. You know, there's not a lot of switching back as far as I've seen statistically. I mean, you hear about it, but most electric car owners are two-car households, and they own at least one gas engine vehicle. Still, that probably won't change for obvious reasons. Like, you can work the math and then kind of understand the inconveniences of owning all electric for both of your cars, so you keep one and you keep another. So you get the convenience of one and you get the convenience of the other, depending on your circumstance. Major car manufacturers have substantially reduced or eliminated their electric or EV rollout over the past 6 months to a year, right?
Yeah, General Motors and Ford have both suspended, as well as canceled all plans to build new facilities. Both were designating few additional facilities to be exclusively battery and EV assembly. And sure, They're done.
Yeah, because that's one thing people don't realize is you build a new car and, oh, we need a new facility to manufacture said new car, right? Because of different processes and assembly techniques and procedures. But the thing everybody forgets is EVs, they require more additional facilities to provide extra components that you don't need as many of or at all in traditional vehicles. You know, car companies have benefited from extreme supplier efficiency over the years with things like car companies don't make their own lead acid batteries. There's no point. right?
No.
So now they're stuck in a place where there's not enough production capacity to do with, to create the batteries. So they need to make them themselves if they're going to compete at all. And now, you know, you have this domino effect going back downstream. It's kind of interesting. The exuberance of, to reuse a phrase that's common in this industry, the irrational exuberance of the EV market is something that, even as it happened, very much befuddled me.
Well, you know, I put on Facebook a video where I was very sarcastic about a Green Party candidate running for the U.S. Senate in New Jersey or New York, I don't recall. Did you see that?
No.
Yeah, this lady claimed that it was the man-made environmental change. Remember, it used to be global warming, global cooling. Of course. What was Al Gore? He was global warming, wasn't he?
I think it was global warming. Well, what is it was global cooling when he was in college. Then it became global warming. Then it became climate change, and they've done a lot of let's call it rebranding of that.
I like that, rebranding. Rebranding of the climate. So this, well,
it's a rebranding of the outcome. The cause is still the same.
Yeah, well, before I go back to, don't let me forget this ding-a-ling-a ying-ying that's running for Senate. You know, ladies and gentlemen, Al Gore, I think he's a few years older than me. I'm not sure. We can look it up. I think we might be the same age. This guy, you know, we were in college, and I vividly remember studying and reading, and one of the primary reasons I said, I'm out of here, I'm going back south. Global, the climate was going to cool, the natural trends. I mean, we actually study that stuff.
Okay, and I can prove to you that that is true.
Go ahead.
It has happened. It is cooler. When you were a kid, you know, pick whatever year, it doesn't really matter.
Say, you know, early 70s, late 60s.
Could we grow oranges in Marion County, Florida?
Yes.
Yes, we could. Pretty close.
Oh, so yeah, no, George, going back to the days of Marjorie Rawlings and all that, oranges were grown up into southern Georgia. People don't realize that.
Now you can't grow them, you can't even grow them, you know, the Tampa area is probably now the barrier for that.
Oh, yeah, Herb.
And even then, they get enough frost and it just kills them. I mean, it takes so many years to build the infrastructure. We were talking about that with, was that something we were talking about with Pat, the oil?
Oh, yeah, the
smoke pots. Little, to keep them.
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys were talking about that and I had no idea. Because, I mean, I've lived here my entire life, and it's something that, like, I've done a few remnants of orange trees. Like, it's the orange state, but I have memories as a kid of seeing some orange groves, but they're all gone now.
Yeah, I think the girl's name, the singer, was Anita Bryant, and she was our spokesperson for the Florida Orange Juice Association, and then she was very anti-gay or whatever caused everybody to get their underwear bind and at the time, and so she lost that gig. So what Paul's talking about is, I want you to think of a like a cannonball. Just think of a cannonball. It's about the size, maybe about 12 inches, 8 inches in a circumference. And the cannonball had a little fuse on the top, but you would unscrew this thing and you'd pour oil into this, and it was a wick. You had a wick, and you'd light it on fire. Well, what does old-fashioned Beverly Hillbillies Earl do? Create smoke. And people think that the heat from the little thing, the little oil pot, was what was going to keep the tree from freezing. That wasn't it at all.
No.
It was the nasty smoke, the oil that would coat the leaves. And so as the temperatures began to drop, you get humidity and you have ice. So you want, for example, to save your orange trees, you have to turn sprinklers on, and people are like, what are you doing? You're going to kill the tree. Well, no, you're coating it because ice is 32 degrees.
Yes.
You don't want that tree to be in the 20s and teens. And
ice creates a thermal barrier.
It does.
It's kind of, it seems like an oxymoron type situation here, but no, it's interesting because the oil preserves the leaf, right?
Exactly.
So it doesn't get frozen and break and prevent it from living. And then the ice creates a thermal barrier for further cold, let's say.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense.
But, you know, I mean, if you're from up north and you come down here and you look at us dumb southerners and you say, you know, them poor old Beverly Hillbilly folks with them orange trees, no wonder they're all gone because they put ice on them and smoked them.
Yeah, no.
No.
Of course, they also failed to understand that, you know, orange trees. What, they take 6-7 years to produce anything useful?
Yeah.
So you kill a tree in one frost and you're screwed for almost a decade far as productivity, because you have to tear it out, replace it, graft. That's another thing people don't realize is orange trees are not sweet naturally. You have to graft them, and it's a whole thing.
Yeah, they grow. Yeah, tangelos grow naturally too.
Yeah, and bananas.
When you were a newborn, Mom and I would go to Disney with you a lot. You were 10 days old when we first took you to Disney. And going down the turnpike through Claremont, I remember I'd always sneeze. My eyes would always water. So I was allergic to orange trees, yeah. No matter what. I have an allergy to orange trees. Not anymore. They're all gone.
Oh, yeah.
Replaced by sticks and mortars and 55-plus communities.
Yeah. Yeah, because the frost just froze them out, and the farmers are like, we're done. Sell it off to the villages or Disney or whoever.
Yeah, I had an appointment years ago with a farmer out there. He was a deputy sheriff, and he was getting ready to retire. He had a orange grove, and we had to do some paperwork. And he said, yeah, come on out. I'd use the help. He said, but wear blue jeans and boots. I'm like, okay. He didn't tell me anything more. He's a great guy. Anyways, I got there. He goes, I'll sign whatever you want, but you got to help me put these pots out. He was hauling ass with his tractor and his trailer and his boys. And I said, yes, that was a good time. And a little bit of whiskey, a little bit of beer, and a lot of laughs over that. So going back to my lady that's running for Senate, she actually said that the earthquakes, the big earthquake that happened in New York, was the result of climate change.
Well, and then on the other side of the aisle, you have, Marjorie Taylor Greene said that this is a sign from God to teaching us or telling us to repent or something.
Be healed in the name of me, myself, and I say.
But think about that. You have this religious response from now both sides of the spectrum.
Need to describe that.
Wild.
That is wild. So what does it mean to have a religious response from both sides of the spectrum? Because I think this is great. Go ahead.
Well, what I mean is that, you know, you have a literal religious response from, from Marjorie Taylor Greene, which is, you know, I'm sure she referenced some biblical something or another, but okay, so that's not unheard of. But then you have a religious style response with regard to the Greenies. Like, some of the stuff they say and the fervor in which they say it very much resembles some old school, let's call it traditional religious talking points.
Oh, by the way, you know, she has a special Bible.
Mm.
Yeah, she has the one with the Book of Moses. And so she's been reading about how... Part in the waters and all that, yeah. I'm going to get in trouble for that. But yeah, you've got science as a new religion. We've got climate change as a new religion. We've got Marjorie Taylor Greene as a new religion. And
Well, anyway, yeah, so it's interesting because the green stuff has followed this kind of this trend over the past few years, and COVID and in particular, I think the source of the increased interest, you know, it was in that time period, but the thing that makes no sense about it is, you know, if you think about, you know, the COVID to, you know, the end of COVID period, right? One of the biggest issues you had was energy prices, in particular natural gas, because there's... you know, total issues with everybody in the world producing any energy at all. But then in particular, everybody's in their houses. There's a need to produce more electricity as people were consuming more in some places than others. You know, just a total dislocation of resources and commodity prices and all of this. And then, of course, you had the Ukraine conflict, and that created a huge issue. What's interesting about that is this all continued in that time period where energy prices were this high, in particular with natural gas generated electricity. That's what I don't understand, because in my mind, the entire time I'm thinking, well, that should kill the entire EV industry for a while when it costs, you know, depending on where you're at, a little bit more to substantially more to recharge your vehicle versus refilling it with regular old gasoline. I don't know, the whole thing never made a lot of sense to me. So it's interesting that it took basically high interest rates to destroy the EV market first, because I guess people started doing the math and they realized, oh, maybe this isn't as efficient. The other thing that was crazy is...
And just real quick, I have done the math with you, and we've talked about this forever. So everybody who's a client of ours, I have said forever, it's a cult of personality when it comes to Tesla. Now, there's no doubt that...
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
There's no doubt that they have made some amazing advancements and technological breakthroughs.
Oh, because they had to. They couldn't have done it without... They couldn't have made their vehicles without inventing a lot of this stuff because it didn't exist.
And you cannot take that away from them. But it has gone from innovation and aha moments to, like, don't let me forget this. I really want to get into this cult of personality when it comes to a couple of different things. So you want to continue with that a little bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just it a lot of people put away the common sense and the facts of the situation, specifically with electric vehicles. And they went all in on this being the new thing. And I think, you know, like I was saying earlier, the math that never really made a lot of sense. Even the math they were talking about with regard to CO2 emissions and all those sorts of things, if you value a reduction in CO2 emissions, sure, maybe there's a little bit less, but you know, the thing you have to remember is it's very much a NIMBY reaction. You know, you create most of the CO2 up front and then you put it on the other side of the world and say that you're clean on your side of the world. There's the net reduction is, I don't know, at least the net reduction in your area sure is great, but you know, there's other issues at play, especially if you look at it as far as a global impact. I don't know, just the whole thing, there's so many little aspects of it that are just silly. And, you know, then it just became a fad where, you know, it's no different than Yetis or Stanleys or whatever the one that was before that. You know, everybody had to go out and get their cups and do their thing and whatever. Well, they went out to go get them because everybody else got them because it's a social trend. So everybody chased electric vehicles, which is, you know, like any other commodity. They chased them because this is the hot thing to get. And it propped up a lot of interesting companies. I mean, obviously Tesla has, I think, some enduring staying power. Electric vehicles, I think, will have a permanent place in our world. I just don't think they'll be as prolific as people think. They're probably going to stay a luxury item, and a convenience item for a class of people that don't take particularly long car trips. But that's the thing people forget is the United States by far has the longest or largest number of people that take car trips and drive the most distance one way on an occasional basis than anywhere else in the world. So it's very much ingrained in our culture. And I don't see a lot of that changing, especially when it comes down to the practical range of a lot of these vehicles. And I'm not talking about, you know, the ones with fantastic ranges and all that stuff. I'm just talking about the things that normal people can afford, the EVs that they're talking about that are going to be in the, say, $30,000 to $40,000 price range that compete with average everyday cars that people are buying. I don't see it. You know, it's a commuter car. You know, so that eliminates a lot of opportunity and a lot of cultural engagement that people would have. So anyway, it's kind of an interesting thing. You just don't really, it's not thought out, and I'll just view it as a fad that I'm going to kind of see the repercussions of that kind of kick into place. I will say that, kind of shifting gears on that a little bit, the introduction of certain renewables and the technologies that have come from that, solar and other methods, have gotten much more efficient.
Absolutely.
And that's one of the, let's call it the upside byproducts of this, leveraging this battery technology to provide, let's call it a stopgap power for power losses in certain communities. There's a lot of extra applications for these technologies that are very first world in nature, but I think will have an enduring effect on how we build out our power grids and how we kind of think about sustainable or at least renewable energy going forward.
So I'm going to take a quick break. We're going to be right back in just a few moments, and we're going to talk about cult of personality. We're going to talk about California. We're going to talk about some of the enduring qualities of things. We're also going to talk a little bit about LED lights, and we're going to talk about movie making. And yeah, I know, movie making, LED lights, greens. So we'll be right back. Listen to the disclaimer and get a cup of coffee. We'll see you in just 1 minute.
You are listening to the Paul Truesdell Podcast, Two Pauls in a Pod. It's time for a coffee break and a seventh inning stretch. Due to our extensive holdings and our clients, you should assume that we have a position in all companies discussed and that a conflict of interest exists. By listening, reading, or using this document, video, podcast, and/or website in any manner, you understand the information presented is provided for informational purposes only and agree to our terms of use and privacy policy. Public and group informational items should never be considered professional advice. Nothing said, written, or otherwise communicated should be construed as an offer, recommendation, or solicitation to buy or sell a security.
And we're back. Listen, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, one and all, thanks for the short little break. Had to get a cup of coffee, had to go to the restroom, and I was thinking about our favorite funny guy, Donald Trump and Joe Biden. And I want you to think about this for a second, because I'm going to tie these guys together. With Tesla, you have Elon Musk, and he is a cult of personality. You have these Elon fans, and fanboys will do anything. You have fanboys also for things like Apple. See, Steve Jobs is dead now, and there's not a cult of personality when it comes to, what's his name?
Tim Cook.
Tim Cook.
Or as Trump called him, Tim Apple.
Tim Apple. Now, let's go to Biden. There is no cult of personality around Biden.
Not really, no.
No. I mean, honestly, I would love to have a beer with the guy. I would have a beer and spend hours with him. I think you'd learn a lot of stuff about world events, just like you would have with Nixon.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Well, the guy's been around so long, I'm sure his anecdotes are interesting, to say the least.
Oh, God, yeah. I'd like to have been that sergeant. Do you remember when Obama got elected and they had a cop had to do something?
The beer summit.
The beer yes. summit, yeah. Get rid of Obama.
I like sign to, of many things to come.
Sign of many things to come. Okay, so Trump is a cult of personality. Tesla, Elon's a cult of personality. You have Apple. Steve was a cult of personality. There's a lot of those cults of personality. I would argue that in a weird way, because he's such an oddball guy. Bill Gates was a cult of personality. I think people just like, how did Alfred E. Newman create Microsoft?
Yeah, there definitely was.
Think about that.
Well, there definitely was a cult of personality back then, for sure.
But I've always said
very
this.
Very different from what we would think of today, though.
Oh no, but think about this. You know, I grew up in the era of Mad Magazine.
Sure.
Bill Gates looked like Alfred E. Newman when he was younger.
Absolutely.
And I think a lot of it was like, okay, if this guy can make it.
I mean, he kind of looks like it today. Still.
Well,
he
still does. He looks like
meanwhile,
a
go
Muppet.
Back. Meanwhile, the best ones to go look at are, go look at Elon, because he very much looked like that then as well. Well, not then, but, you know, in the
he was bald
in the 90s.
Then.
Yeah, early late 90s. And then same thing with Bezos. And you compare him to today, and it's like, who? What happened to these guys?
But the point...
A lot of TRT.
Yes. Joe Rogan would know a little bit about that.
Oh, yeah.
Here's the thing, guys. When you have a company and you have a CEO who is a cult of personality, what happens when that person dies? A lot of times the company has a real hard time.
Yeah, it depends.
It could be run really, really well. But when it comes to stock pricing, a lot of people buy based upon stupidity. So when you're doing investment advisory work, you've got to take that into consideration. Just like green has become a cult, and we call it a religious, a science. Now, here's a couple of things. The data simply doesn't pan out. For example, Tesla has, I don't know if they've officially canceled, but for all practical purposes, all research shows the Gigafactory they were getting ready to build in Mexico is done, okay? So they're done with that. And then on top of that, you've got California always, just saying a nonstop, we've got 50% green energy. But they still are using fossil fuel energy. They're using well over 50%. But the thing is, they're drawing energy from out of state, and they don't count that.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. So they're drawing power from the surrounding states, because other than the state of Texas, what do we have?
They just count what they make.
Bingo.
Right? So, yeah.
Yeah. So, they're using 10 gigawatts a day of fossil fuel-based energy just in the L.A. basin. Just in the L.A. basin, which is larger than most small countries.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
So my consideration and thinking is this. If you got a company that's based in California, it's just a matter of time before the laws, rules, and regulations of Gavin Newsom and his party of crazies is going to hit your bottom line.
Yeah, it depends. It depends a lot. I mean, in all these places, there's a shift, right? The thing I was thinking is with old Elon, the market for EVs is going to continue in places like China.
Well, there's a reason for that.
Yeah, because China doesn't have the fossil fuel-based energy that most of us do. And it's all imported, right?
Correct.
So EVs are going to stay popular purely because it's a rational response, since they're building lots of electricity plants, and that's a national security thing for them. Their logistics are going to have to, I can totally see them going the California route, mandating all electric on everything, partially to help with the smog and pollution and all that sort of stuff, but also to keep stuff working if they get oil embargoed, like Japan did in the previous century.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I want you to correct me. I do believe China, while they lack Beverly Hillbillies oil, they do have copper, they have lithium, they have graphite, they have a lot of the raw materials that are needed to make batteries. And so it would make sense that they would be doing nuclear power. So if you've got atomic energy coupled with electricity.
Absolutely.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
They also don't drive from Walla Walla Bing Bang to Zip Zam Boom. I mean, they're not us.
No, they don't do that. I mean
they're pedal powers.
There's a lot of transportation long distance that goes on in China, but it's all public transportation. The thing about what I was saying, so you take this into effect and you consider Tesla's interesting relationship with the Chinese government. That's something that I would keep an eye on, because you see a lot of, let's call it ignoring obvious things. I see Elon's public commentary is comical at times. He was very mad at Brazil for banning X or something recently.
Yeah.
And he said it's the most draconian thing that has happened anywhere or something.
Really?
It's like, interesting, because your interesting bedfellow in China with regard to Tesla bans X in its entirety, but I never saw any place where he got mad about that. But that's just, some little small, I'm sure, totally schizophrenic, paranoid conspiracy observation on my part. I'm sure I'm just making this up.
Situational ethics, I guess. But here's the other thing. The thing that also, and I'm going to continue to harp on this, and you know what's kind of nice about it, is we're sitting here in our studio and we're having a conversation. We haven't apologized and said to people about, I know it's going to upset you, yada, yada, yada. Just like when we're talking about COVID. It's like, I don't kill me over this, but you got to understand the difference between RNA, DNA, vaccine versus a genetic modifier. I think people are beginning to really realize that now. Okay. Mox mix, nobody's going to do anything about it. Nobody has the guts. But the big thing is, I think one of the things we have to realize is that a lot of the transformers and cables in this country The electrical grid hasn't been updated for 75 years.
Yes.
And it's not because of neglect. It's just some things you just can't upgrade easily, which I think it would be interesting to talk about Los Angeles. Let's talk about making movies in Los Angeles.
Yeah, we watched a very interesting little documentary where this guy reviewed a few seminal movies over the past, 20, 30 years. I guess it's been 30.
The ultimate was the Tom Cruise movie.
Yeah, Collateral, and then there was a Hong Kong-based movie. Anyway, but the point was, is the guy kind of reviewed and went through and showed that the effect of street lighting and how it affected movie making and the perception of, you know, the environment and you know, whether it was doom and gloom or a seedy underbelly and whatever. And it was very interesting, though, because he went through and he explained, the evolution of film and how you couldn't shoot at night because it just required so much light. And, at a certain point, film got fast enough that they could actually start to perceive something useful out of a nighttime shot, actually outdoors. And then as time went on, you know, the film stocks got better and better and better. And then we got digital. And then anyway, you got this fantastic little history on the evolution of streetlights and lamps and all of these things and how they evolved from, what it was in the 60s, or I'm sorry, the 70s and 80s. But basically it went from these arc lights to these really inefficient incandescent bulbs, and then the oil embargo, they got replaced with, I can't remember the name of it, but anybody that was alive back then, it was very, cold and white and kind of almost green.
They had those yellow sodium lights.
Well, that's what came later.
Yeah.
But what I'm talking about is the efficiency needs and the energy crisis of the 70s drove forward the development of and the release of this other style of light, mm-hmm. where they weren't as good as the incandescents, but they consumed a tremendous amount less energy. And anyway, then they turned into sodium vapor lights, and then obviously those things got replaced with LEDs. The sodium vapor lights being the very yellow kind of. Dim, not nearly as blue lights that I think most of us have a kind of mental image of when you think of a street light.
Right.
And, of course, in the transition to LEDs, I think everybody in the country, especially if you've traveled a little bit, even if it didn't happen in your backyard, you'll know of a place where it did. When they started replacing these things, they were, I don't know if they were cheap knockoffs or what the deal was, but these certain brand of lights got installed all over the place, and you can still see it in some cities where they're basically purple.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
It's horrible.
Horrible.
There's a place I'm thinking of where there's entire areas of the city where they're still purple, and they were replacing them. They were still in the process of replacing them within the past year. It was like, what is this whole district? Is this the prostitution district now? Because it looks like a nightclub or a strip club. That's the kind of lighting you get, but it was everywhere on the streets. It was so creepy. Anyway, it's basically this drive for efficiency, right? You know, want more lights. You want to be able to see at night. Obviously, a lot of that is affected by the fact that there's a lot more cars on the road, and no matter how good the lights are for your vehicle, street lights make it a lot easier to drive. Some of that's changed with LEDs, but still it's omnidirectional, right? So, you know, you can only see what you're shining at. Anyway, it's a very interesting thing, but there's the effect it had on way people view certain styles of cinema is huge. But yeah, digital film, digital movie production really took it up to the next level. And that was one of the things they showed as the movie Collateral with Tom Cruise as a...
I have a Collateral suit. Remember that?
Yes.
Yeah. So if anybody wants to know, I have my black, I have a white shirt, but it works really great with black, but I have a suit that is tailored after collateral. All of this stems from one single thing. It goes back to the 73-74 Yom Kippur War. And just so you know, Richard Nixon was president of the United States back in the day. He hadn't resigned yet. He would resign in 74. And, of course, you had the Saudis were very upset that we took the side of the Israelis. And we had the Organization of Arab. It was not OPEC. It was OAPEC, the Organization of Arab Producing States, and they cut everybody off and shut it down. And so then you had 79 when the same thing happened again. But you can make an argument. Well, we picked a side and got involved, and we paid a price. And that includes all the way down to streetlights. I mean, it does. But it just here's what it is.
But you fast forward to today, and you know, despite the kicking and screaming of certain political persuasions and all of this, the United States has finally, if you look at the timeline, it really happened under the Obama administration, became energy independent.
Yep.
And
that's true.
Other politicians like to take credit for this, but not particularly accurate. No. I mean, we can mark the X on the chart where it officially happened, but as we know, you know, things take a long time to develop. You can't just pop an oil well in the ground and say you're energy independent overnight. So anyway, but if you look at the outcome of the Ukraine conflict and all of this, the United States, as of around 2022, became the largest, one of the largest oil exporters in the world. And it's crazy to see the skyrocket over the past couple of years, where we have this tremendous production capacity and now we're exporting it and we're on the opposite end of that story right now, back to the way we were in, you know, around the 1930s and 40s, where we were net energy exporters and we were sending oil to other developed parts of the world. They're no longer dependent on cheap Middle Eastern oil, propping them up for dubious economic gain.
Yeah, and you know, it's just, I'm going to say it again. I think that there's a lot of opportunities when you are listening to us, and I want you to think. One of the opportunities for those of you who are interested, get a hold of me. We can talk about this. It's a venture capital type thing, but movie sets, movie studios, movie sound stages, audio sound stages. I mean, there's a huge demand. Content, a big demand for content. But my suggestion to somebody is to think very seriously about what we said about lighting. And if you go to, for example, Universal Studios and you go to Disney, the backlot tours, folks, you need to be able to take your streetlights down, put other streetlights up, different types of bulbs for different kinds of effects, because you cannot get it with CGI. You can do all you want to do.
You can get close, but it just doesn't look the same. No. The real, there's a reason. You know, some of it is, let's call it the uninitiated think that, you know, certain things, people go through a tremendous effort to replicate the past and do things is purely just a waste of resources. But there's just certain aspects of film in particular that you just can't fix or replace or do the same way, get the same result without the same kinds of lenses and the same kinds of film. I mean, There's some movies that have been filmed and they go back and they have to find the right specific kind of era reproduction film to get the same look.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, just the way the light captures on the actual film stock, it's not the same. And you can see it. And that's what makes a lot of movies in particular really popular movies such interesting time capsules, because they capture more than just the story. There's so much other there. A good example is go back and watch Blade Runner, the original one.
Oh, okay. I wouldn't have thought of that.
Well, we did that. I mean, we watched them.
Yeah, no, I did.
The past year.
We did, but I wouldn't have thought of
it. And watch the original one versus the sequel or follow-up or whatever you call it.
Not the same.
And it's not about that it's not the same. They're just different movies.
Yeah.
Like one requires the other. It's the same universe. It's the same story. But it's very interesting, especially when you see them side by side. Anyway, and because it very much captures what was capable back then. It's state of the art for movie making, and how much the real world affected a movie that was supposed to take place in the future.
Well, we were watching this, and I had the thought, and I lost it while we were talking about it. It came back to me. I'm going to describe something to you, and it's literally my first shooting. Imagine it's humid, and you're outside, and your skin is moist. I mean, you think it's raining, but it's not. It's beating up that much, right?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
You have to walk very carefully because no matter what kind of shoes you have, it's very slick. And, of course, the ground is full of urine and crap everywhere. You're in a really wonderful urban environment. You got the smells. You can feel that, right? You can sense that whole thing. And you've got those orange lights. You got it? And you're not quite sure what you're seeing. The contrast is not great. So when Roscoe decides to go boom, 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 and you decide to go back at him, it is what it is, right? But that thing we watched with Collateral, when they were going through that, there were a couple scenes I was like, oh, God, that brings back memories.
Yeah.
It just does.
Yeah.
So, well.
No, it is interesting. I mean, that's one aspect of this little documentary. I'll give you the link. We can put it in the show notes. The guy talks about how sometime in the past 10 years, how L.A. started to make this transition to LED lights. And one of the things they did is they thought they found the optimal temperature for lights to use.
Oh, I forgot about that.
And they ended up using like 3,000 Kelvin or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I could have told you immediately, like, that's way, way, way too white. It's not yellow enough. People will hate it. And when they first installed them in certain places, people said, oh, great, I now live in a prison. I've got prison lights outside my house. And it's just, so now they've optimized it and brought it back. Not as much towards that old sodium vapor, really yellow, but somewhere in between.
Well, I haven't done any research on it, but I'm really quite comfortable in saying that the reason why people cannot stand uber bright lights that are white at night is that it's a shock to your, I'm going to get my word screwed up, circadian system. I mean, it's nighttime, it's evening, you know, I'm beginning, there's a different tempo. I'm not articulating it very well. I think there's probably a lot to do with it.
Yeah, it's the blue light spectrum impedes your melatonin production.
Exactly, there you go.
It keeps you more awake.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty cool. What else you got there? Otherwise, we'll start wrapping it up. I'd like to talk about cash. And cash is important, isn't it? We talk to our clients all the time. You got to have enough cash.
Absolutely.
And there's some really great articles, finally, after all these decades of me basically spitting in the wind, where people begin to realize that those who use investment advisors based upon assets under management, you know, we're going to talk more about that, how they have screwed people for getting early Social Security and taking pensions and not having enough cash and blah, blah. I'm not going to go into the details, but there's a problem. There's way too much cash sitting on the sidelines of some of these big companies.
Yeah, a lot of companies, well, Apple at one point had a net cash stockpile of like $260 billion, some insane amount. And
Facebook now has $570 billion.
And, well, but companies like Apple and Facebook and stuff.
I'm sorry. It's my bad. The parent companies of Google and Facebook together have a collective $570 billion. I misspoke.
Yeah. So. But the thing is, you know, Apple only has a net cash stockpile of like $50 billion, $60 billion, because all these companies have leveraged tremendous amounts of debt. So they maintain a lot of cash on their books, but, you know, it cancels out with a tremendous debt load as well. And companies like Apple, they've in particular had a lot of money stored overseas. They brought it back by basically using debt, cheap debt to do it, and then they paid dividends with that. And so there's a lot of very weird or unusual tactics. Instead of just spending your money and paying taxes, they do all these unusual, let's call it financial engineering. So they don't have as much as you would think when you even it out against debt obligations, but they still have a tremendous amount. And one thing I didn't see on that list is who was it? Cisco. At one point had a huge cash pile. I don't know what they've done with it, though. I haven't paid attention.
We had a real vigorous discussion before we went into a studio a couple of days ago. And one of the things I have always said, and I'm going to say it again, the United States federal government in Washington, D.C., the senators, the congressmen, in women. The president of the United States, don't care who it is, it could be Uncle Joe or what's his name, Donald Trump. Look, when you continue to tax dividends by publicly traded companies the way they do it, there's no incentive to pay out dividends unless you have some of these old, you know, dividend history companies like Ford. I'm not going to go into a lot of the details on this, but the bottom line is, gosh darn, it should be nice if you would just pay out profits. And instead of everybody focusing on, you know, growth, 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 stock value, how about focusing on profits? Are you making a profit? And the laws are just designed to, I'm not going to get into the details, but Apple, Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Meta, even Exxon, Berkshire, Hathaway, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, AT&T, they all have boatloads of billions and billions of dollars of cash. How about a return of my money before I get a return on my money? Pay me my dividends.
Yeah, I agree. The probably two big things that do that would help alleviate this issue is, well, bring it back to before that. This is a huge indicator of a lack of competition in my mind. If these people were spending money and fighting the good fight, as it were, this money could be deployed if you had real competition. Instead, they hoard onto it because they don't have any place to use it, right? Because these companies are just so tremendously huge, it's insane. So that's one thing. But the other thing that's interesting is exactly what you're saying. I do think that if you had a corporate tax deduction for if you paid your profits out as dividends, you would alleviate a lot of this. But in particular, I think you also need to optimally make this work, especially for some of these large multinationals, need the same thing with regard to getting foreign profits back as well, because that's a huge problem too. I mean, that's one of the reasons I mentioned earlier that Apple, this financial engineering to borrow money cheaply and domestically against their cash piles overseas. You know, domestically, they don't have a ton of money, and one of the reasons it is because it's tax less, and they've done all these things to avoid taxes. That's one of the reasons they have accumulated all this money. So in general, it's a very interesting problem. I mean, at one point, I mean, on one hand, you don't really want to reward people that are skirting tax obligations, but at the same time, you want to get the biggest benefit for shareholders, because at the end of the day, a lot of these, the majority of these shareholders are U.S.-based, their companies or people. So that money is going to be taxed on income, on an income basis on those people. So it's just, it's weird. I mean, I think in general, I definitely do agree. I mean, you have some good companies out there, like a lot of the industrials, oil companies and stuff like that, that still pay huge, heavy dividends. You sent me that thing the other day about Stanley Black & Decker, which owns DeWalt and tons of these
Steady
other
Steady Eddie.
Yep, Steady Eddie, and they've had increasing dividends every year since like 1968 or something.
It's huge.
I mean, they're a old school, traditionally minded company, and they're paying their money out as dividends. But look at their financials, and they pay a ton in taxes to do so. So it's, you know, on one hand, would you rather more people pay more income taxes if you were the government, or would you rather suck it all from a couple of the big sources like companies at the expense of a lot less companies paying out dividends? I personally would opt for the former, because, you know,
but there's
more money in more people's pockets makes more sense in my mind. But
and there's multiple ways of paying it out. I'm thinking about doing an animal house. Just real quickly. So I want you to go back to, you know, John Belushi, Animal House. You got that. And we're going to wrap up in just a minute. Guess what? In 2010, Steve Jobs was alive. And he said, holy cow, we had a $40 billion cash pile. Now, there's no doubt that Steve Jobs has watched Animal House like me a few times, because he said,
yes,
let's have a giant toga party.
Yeah.
So maybe that's what we need to do. So,
but that's, it's interesting though, because that comment is you know, can be taken as flippant and not serious, but I think it much like the lights we were talking about earlier, there's more to that statement. They've analyzed it. They don't know what to do with it. Like, you're so successful and all this stuff, but at the end of the day, okay, we have all this money. What do we do with it? And, you know, this is why you see a lot of successful people. They build big businesses. They do whatever. They're highly successful for one reason or another. And they kind of just now stop competing because what's the point? Like, okay, I've got $5 billion. I've aggressively done all the things I ever wanted to do. And I still have all of that left. Like what the hell do I do with all this stuff?
They do super giant monster gargantuan yachts.
Oh yeah.
And they build bunkers and are investigating cryonautics or cryonetics, whatever
but
it is.
But even then, I mean, unless you go absolutely crazy, a lot of these things, you just get to diminishing returns as far as how much money you can spend on stuff. So now we're talking about, you know, individuals or estates that are worth, you know, a couple billion dollars. What do you do if you're a company that has $100 billion in cash?
That's a few dollars.
Right? The only thing you can really do is just buy other companies. I mean, companies like Apple, you know, you can, or any of these companies, really. I mean,
you could buy a country.
NVIDIA, all the big tech companies, oil companies, whatever. You can look at their R&D budgets. It's basically infinite. They spend whatever they think they need to, within reason, of course. And they still, it's a rounding error. I mean, you know, Apple's R&D has exploded over recent years, and that included their wacky experiment trying to build a car and all kinds of other stuff.
That's a waste of money.
But even then, their R&D budget is only like $5 billion a year or something. It's just, it's nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, true R&D, like stuff that, anyway, it's very, when I say true R&D, what I mean is versus like a tax-deductible R&D, which can be, you know, it very much depends on how you classify things. But anyway, it's very interesting to consider because it is a serious problem that you use. I've thought about a long time. I mean, I've thought about it going back to those days when Steve was still alive. That what do you do with that kind of money, especially if you're Apple? And like, you know, it's hard. It's really hard to imagine. And then Apple has a very weird strategy because they don't buy big companies.
No.
I think their biggest acquisition ever is like $2-3 billion, something like that.
Yeah, it's but the not primary much. Acquisition is for people. And that's the thing. A few episodes ago, we talked about the reality in life is there's only a handful of people in the world that are actually super crazy brainiacs. And when I mean a handful of people, for every 1,000 people, you're lucky if you get one or two that really have a massive, incredible IQ and capability of doing the things that need to be done. We know that. That which, is what it is.
Which is wacky because some of the things I've read about Apple's extremely stingy nature with regard to employee compensation compared to some of the other big companies.
Fanboys, even though they may be brainiacs, they're fanboys. You know that.
But the loss of talent at times is just insane because, you know, you've got companies like OpenAI and NVIDIA and stuff that suck, you know, like you said, you know, very, you know, we have one of 20 of these people on the planet and we hoarded five of them because we were able to hire them away. And now three of them are leaving because, you know, NVIDIA is willing to pay them, you know, $1 million a year plus.
No different than the story of...
And Apple's response is, well, you should just enjoy working here because it's Apple. It's like,
Well, no. And that's what happened. I went a little long on this, but that's what happened with BlackBerry. Research in Motion. I mean, that guy, Lisi, had the fortitude to go, I will pay you whatever. I'm backdating options. They all got in trouble, but they needed the people, needed to pay them.
And, well,
end of story. They were successful.
Well, yeah, with employment strategies, I mean, that's one thing that's interesting to consider is there's the hire lots of people, scale out, you know, horizontal as far as you can and just get an army, right? But then there's also the strategy of hiring the absolute experts, paying them as much as you can or are willing to, and, you know, having the extreme brainiac talent to do the R&D. And in recent years, the one who gets credit for most success in that arena is OpenAI. That's what they did. I can't remember the names of the people, but they hired a couple people, paid them like $1 million plus a year, absolute experts in their fields, and that's what a lot of OpenAI's advancements have come from is, you know, a couple really wild brainiacs who understood this extremely niche technology.
We're going to wrap it up, but that's not something new. We did it with NASA. We did it with the atomic bomb. We've done it many, many times. But again, I'm going to say it might be one of the least controversial uses of extreme excess capital is a national toga party. So if you're interested in having a national toga party, give me a call at 212-433-2525. That's 212-433-2525 and say, I want a toga party. You can text me as well, and we'll see if we can't get this thing going. My name is Paul Truesdell the Elder. Joining me today is my best buddy, my guy that we made a few years ago. Who is it?
Paul the Younger.
Paul the Younger, Paul the Elder. With that, Tippecanoe, Tyler 2, we're out of here.
Now, you boys seen your grade point average yet? Well, have you?
I have, sir. I know it's a little below par.
It's more than a little below par, Mr. Hoover. It stinks. It's the lowest on campus. It's the lowest in Faber history.
Well, sir, we're hoping that our midterm grades will really help our average.
Laugh now, because you clowns have been on double secret probation since the beginning of this semester.
Secret probation?
And that means one more slip-up, one more mistake, and this fraternity of yours has had it, Faber.
Well, that was pleasant. Nice of him to stop by, don't you think?
We've got to do something. He's serious this time. I think he knows about the exams.
He's right.
You're right. We gotta do something.
Absolutely.
You know what we gotta do?
Toga party.
We're on double secret probation, whatever that is. We can't afford to have a toga party.
You guys up for a toga party?
Toga! Toga!
Yeah, I think they like the idea, Hoove.
Oh, Otter, please don't do this.
We got news for you, pal. They're gonna nail us no matter what we do.
But we might as well have a good time.
Toga! 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 Toga!
You have been listening to the Paul Truesdell podcast. For additional items, serious to humorous, wisdom to occasional outrage, of various degrees, visit paultruesdell.com. That's paultruesdell.com.
Paul Grant Truesdell.
Roger that. Dust off in five. On the floor, now!